Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty's got the day off today. Will a cold dose of reality cool the feverish dreams of Eagles fans Saturday night? Who knows? The Birds take the field on a wing and a prayer at 4:45 Saturday afternoon at the Link against a very capable 11-6 Atlanta Falcons team. The Falcons led at quarterback by Penn Charter alum Matt Ryan. There is some comfort in the fact that Ryan doesn't have a stellar record at the Link, although Eagles quarterback Nick Foles has looked shaky recently. We'll talk about Foles, Ryan, Nate Sudfeld, Philly's much-vaunted defense, and much more as we welcome back to Radio Times Ray Dittinger, commentator for NBC Sports Philadelphia. Hi, Ray.
Hello, Mary.
And Mike Sielski is sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Good to see you again, Mike.
You too, Mary. Thanks for having me.
And before we get going, let's get the number out. If you'd like to join the conversation, it's 888-477-9499. Or you can send us an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, the Eagles are a number one seed underdog going into Saturday's game. How often does that happen?
It doesn't. I don't think. Yeah.
It's the first time it's ever happened that you've had a number one seed as an underdog to a number six seed. It's never happened before. But the circumstances dictate that. I mean, the Eagles became a number one seed largely on the play of Carson Wentz this season, but Carson Wentz isn't available right now. So their Eagles are, and everybody's seen them. They know they're a different team right now, and they're going to have to find different ways to win.
Yeah. Give us a quick overview of the matchup first, and we'll get into some of the nitty-gritty. So the Falcons are the defending NFC champs, Mike.
Yeah, they went to the Super Bowl last year and probably should have won the game at a 28-3 lead and ended up losing in overtime to Tom Brady and the Patriots. They're a bit of a different team this season compared to last season. They're much more reliant on their defense. They lost their offensive coordinator, a guy named Kyle Shanahan. He was kind of the maestro of their offense last season. Under him, Matt Ryan had the best season of his career, was the NFL MVP. Shanahan's now the head coach of the San Francisco 49ers, and the new offensive coordinator, Steve Sarkisian, under him, things have been a little bumpier, and the Falcons have not really been a consistent offensive team, but their defense has kept them in most games and lately has really been playing well. So this is going to be a difficult matchup, I think, for the Eagles.
So for the Eagles, though, better the Falcons than the Rams, right?
I think so. I think that of all the possibilities that existed out there for the Eagles as their first draw in the playoffs, they got the most favorable one. But that's by no means, and as Mike described, I think he described the Falcons very well. This is by no means easy. To say that they got the best matchup isn't to suggest it's going to be an easy one. It won't. But I would rather be playing the Falcons than the Saints, who are a really good team, really good team. They might be the best team in the NFC. Or the Carolina Panthers, who are a good team, and they have Cam Newton is very up and down, but when he's on his game, he's very hard to beat. So I think for all of those reasons, and I mean, I don't know how much history figures into it, but the Falcons are on a long run of not playing well in Philadelphia. I mean, of their last eight games in Philadelphia, they're 1-7. So now, how much does that factor in? I don't know, but it certainly doesn't hurt.
So Matt Ryan apparently is 3-3 in his career, you know, playing at the Link. Why?
Well, it's funny how teams in most sports, I think, well, certainly in baseball and in football, to a certain extent, kind of tailor themselves to the conditions that they're in all the time. And the Falcons, for years and years, have played all their home games in a dome. So they tend to build both their offense and their defense for that kind of fast-track turf that they play on at least eight games a season. So when they get outside in the cold and on grass, that style of play doesn't necessarily work as well. You know, they have excellent skill position players, wide receivers and running backs. Ryan can act like something of a point guard, just kind of distributing the ball to whoever happens to be open on a particular play. And their defense is really predicated on speed. It's not a particularly big group of players, but they are fast. And that allows them, you know, particularly on a turf field, to really excel, not so much maybe on grass outdoors.
Let's talk about the underdog status of the Eagles. Can that help, right?
Yeah, I think it does.
How?
I think it does. One thing, and this applies especially in football, but and at all levels, high school, college, NFL, there's no rallying point for a football team that's better or more universal than no respect. If a coach gets up in front of a group of football players and says, nobody respects us, nobody thinks we can win, nobody outside of this room thinks that we can win, it works every time. I mean, it's amazing how these guys have heard this countless times in their career, from the time they were little kids all the way up through college and into pros. And you would think at a certain point they'd roll their eyes and say, yeah, yeah, yeah. But it always works. And so the Eagles are in the very rare position of being the number one seed playing at home, and yet the theme is going to be talked about all week. And you've already heard some of the players address it, is nobody respects us, nobody thinks we can do this. It's very rare to be the number one seed and be able to play the no respect card. But yeah, from a motivational standpoint, yeah,
gives them an edge.
It's good to have it, you know, and it always works. And you can already hear Doug didn't address it a whole lot yesterday. In fact, he sort of dismissed it. But the players have talked about it, the idea that nobody thinks that we can win. Well, you know, that has been working with football teams since the days of Newt Rockne, and it still works today.
So Doug Peterson, let Nick Foles be Nick Foles. What does that mean, Mike?
I think that's a good question. I think that means for Foles and for the game that Peterson's going to call in terms of what kind of plays he wants the Eagles to run, I think it's not asking Foles to do more than he's capable of doing. And I think that's part of the reason, probably the main reason, why people are skeptical that the Eagles can either win this game or, if they do, advance to the Super Bowl, which is that, as Ray mentioned earlier, not just their entire offense, but really their last two off seasons and seasons have been built around both acquiring and then helping Carson Wentz. And he has a unique set of skills in terms of being able to throw the ball, evade pass rushers, run for first downs. He's accurate. He's smart. You know, he was trending upward at a rate that nobody could have predicted, really. So to not have him, and you can't ask Nick Foles to do the same things that he can do. So yeah, whether that means simpler, shorter passes, whether it means running the ball more often, I think let Nick be Nick means don't ask Nick to do more than he's capable of.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right. There's what the Eagles have to do is every offense has a framework within its design, within its playbook. Plays are supposed to run on a certain schedule, ball's supposed to come out at a certain time, patterns are supposed to be run a certain way. There's a very strict formula to the way offenses are designed. And within that framework, the thing that made Carson Wentz great was he could play outside of that framework. If things broke down, if everything, all of a sudden the ball was snapped and nothing was happening the way it was designed to, he had a unique set of physical skills where he could take that play and just create something else out of it. And some of his biggest plays this year were purely spontaneous, improvisational plays that only a very rare player can make. Nick is not that, never will be that. So the idea is now you have to go up against a really good defense and have a quarterback who, and this gets back to the point of what Doug's saying, let Nick be Nick. Look, just don't try to do all that other stuff. Just play within the framework of the offense, and I think we'll be okay. The defense is going to play well. The special teams are good. We just have to execute our offense. But a lot of this responsibility does fall on Doug Peterson, because he's going to have to come up with a game plan that's going to maximize the skill set that Nick Foles has.
Let's go back to Carson Wentz for just a moment, and let's go back to the beginning of the season when we were in this studio and we were talking about the Eagles. The season hadn't really gotten underway. I'm going to poke a little bit here. Nobody, including myself in this studio, thought they were going to do what they did this season.
Well, I don't think anybody...
Could you have foreseen what Carson Wentz was capable of?
No, I think that's the difference. I think, you know, everybody was... I think both Ray and I and a lot of people were pretty optimistic and sanguine about the quarterback Carson Wentz would eventually become.
Right.
I don't think any of us saw him becoming that quarterback as quickly as he did. I mean, by the midpoint of the season, it was like, holy cow, the Eagles might have the MVP of the entire league here playing quarterback for them. And so, you know, as we mentioned, that position is so important, and they did so much both to acquire him and to then add pieces to help him. That to have him play like that took them into a stratosphere that nobody expected at the beginning of the season. I think, you know, Ray and I have done shows together where we've both said we guessed around 8-8, 9-7.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden they're sure. They're 11-2, you know, and you're wondering, you know, where did this come from? Well, it came from mostly the quarterback and some smart decisions there.
Yeah. When Wentz went down with his knee injury, there was some talk, you know, in the papers and in commentary about maybe somehow getting Colin Kaepernick to step up, you know, to join the team, to bring him onto the team instead of going to Foles, to move forward. What did you think?
I didn't think there was a chance in the world it was going to happen.
Yeah.
There's no way you're going to bring a guy in who hadn't played football all year and bring him in and introduce him to your offense, give him the playbook, and have him ready to play in that period of time. I mean, and then I'm not even going to get into the other baggage that Kaepernick would have brought with him, which would have been, the thing I hate most is injuries, but next to that is distractions, what they call distractions. And this was a team that part of their success this year was the fact that it really was a unique team. Not to use an overworked term, but there was a very unique kind of chemistry on that team where these guys really did like each other. They really did play together. They played for each other. And this was as close to being a quote-unquote team as any NFL team I've been around. I mean, and that was a big part of it. So Kaepernick could come in and be the nicest guy in the world, but he would have been dragging behind him every network news crew in America. And you never know how that's going to tip the balance in there. So I think from that standpoint, it didn't make a lot of sense. But from a more practical X's and O's standpoint, it just didn't make any sense. Because at that point in the season, you couldn't bring a quarterback in and get him up to speed that if you needed him to get on the field, that he could perform.
So as far as the setup is concerned, so then Foles is back up in Sudfeld. Nate Sudfeld is the third. That's the right setup.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting about the Kaepernick question is there was a time in training camp as the preseason was winding down where Foles did not play for several preseason games because he had an elbow injury. And the fear, and I actually wrote about this at the time, if you were going to ever consider bringing Colin Kaepernick in, that would have been the time, because the question about whether Foles was going to be healthy enough to be a steady backup if Wentz were to get hurt was an open question at that time, because he wasn't playing. And there was a lot of mystery about whether his arm was healthy enough for him to play. So the way they've got it set up now, Ray's point is right on about the fact that you can't bring in any quarterback. I don't care if it's Colin Kaepernick. I don't care if it's the ghost of Norm Van Brocklin. At that point in the season when Wentz got hurt, who is just completely unfamiliar with your system, never mind all the other accoutrements that would have accompanied him.
Yeah, and this reminder too, Nick Foles is no slouch. He's a former Pro Bowl MVP. He started a wild card playoff game for the Eagles. That was back in 2013. It was apparently a great game. So what are the positives here that he brings to the table? Aside from that Cowboys game, we're all still trying to recover from in Philadelphia.
Yeah, the Cowboys game was really bad, and the Raiders game was really bad. I mean, he's coming off two very poor performances. But Nick is a very smart guy. He's a guy who can throw. He can throw the ball. He doesn't have as strong an arm as Wentz, but there are certain throws that he can make. And as we saw in 2013, if guys get open, he can get them the football. I think he was the beneficiary that year of it being the first year of the Chip Kelly offense, which was revolutionary in its design. And for that first year, I mean, Chip was one, two, three steps ahead of most of the defenses in the NFL. So his quarterbacks were getting big windows to throw into.
Right.
And so Nick was the beneficiary of that.
Hold that thought, Ray. We're going to take a break right now, and then we'll be back in just a moment here on Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, along with Ray Didinger of NBC Sports Philadelphia. Philadelphia Inquirer sports columnist Mike Sielski is with us as well. We're talking about the Eagles and the Falcons on Saturday, and our number is 888-477-9499 if you'd like to jump in. Stay with us. This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moskowain. And we are looking ahead to Saturday and the big game at the Link, which, of course, is Eagles-Falcons. Eagles' first postseason game of the season. We're trying to figure out, or at least do a little bit of prognostication as to what might happen on Saturday. In studio, Mike Sielski of the Philadelphia Inquirer, Ray Didinger of NBC Sports Philadelphia. And again, if you'd like to join the conversation to give us your two cents, it's 888-477-9499. Send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And going into the break, Ray Didinger, we were talking about Nick Foles playing under Chip Kelly. This is in 2013, and he had a tremendous, it was a wild card playoff game for the Eagles. Doug Peterson or Chip Kelly, who suits Foles best?
Oh, wow.
If you could take that 2013 version of Chip Kelly, I think that would suit just about any quarterback.
Yeah, I think so. But the offense that Chip had that year, now ultimately the league caught up with it. and that's why Chip's back in college now. But that first year, he had a lot of tactical advantages. I mean, teams just didn't know how to deal with his pace, the tempo, the routes that the guys were running. And if you look back on that year, I mean, listen, give Nick a lot of credit because he played extremely well. But he had guys wide open all year. And I don't mean just a little open. I mean wide open. Well, that's not the same case right now. But I think that in fairness, what they're running here now is a more – what Doug's running is a more, for the lack of a better term, more traditional kind of NFL offense. But what I think Doug has done very well is I think that he, along with Frank Reich and John DeFilippo, have done a great job of developing Wentz and bringing him along and educating him to the NFL game and making him understand the pace at which the NFL game – because it's – I think people can't lose sight of the fact that he came out of a very small college program. I mean, North Dakota State is not Alabama. You know, it's not one of those programs. So he had to learn the pace of the NFL game, the speed of this game. And I think they've taught him to compete at it at a remarkably fast rate.
Yeah. He's wonderful. I mean, he's really fun to watch. However, I will say that during the season when I was watching those games, maybe this is the mother in me coming out, but I kept thinking he's not sliding. He's mixing it up. He's going to get hurt. I think I said that for three games straight before he finally went down. I'm no genius, but was he taking unnecessary risks?
I think... You are not the first person to say that. You're not the first person who follows the team regularly to think that. And I guarantee you, you were not the first person. There were people inside the NovaCare complex who were probably thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
It's a double-edged sword. That style of play, you know, is endearing to your teammates. It gives you a credibility that you're willing to run and take a hit for a first down. Hey, this is our quarterback. This is our leader. And Wentz is certainly physically more capable of making those kinds of plays than virtually every other quarterback in the NFL. So again, it's a double-edged sword, and you hold your breath every time he does it. The problem is, you know, when he makes a cut or takes a hit, as he did against the Rams that day at the Coliseum in Los Angeles, that sort of thing can happen. And I think now the broader question, getting kind of beyond just this game and this season, is A, how does he recover from this torn ACL in his left knee, and B, assuming he does, what kind of quarterback is he then? Is he the same quarterback? Is he a
more
lesser
cautious?
Yeah, is he a lesser iteration of the guy he was this season?
How long is that going to take? I'm hearing anywhere from 9 months to a year, right?
The physical part of it?
The recovery from the ACL.
Well, I think a lot of people seem to be assuming that, well, he'll be there to start next season. I don't know. I think you're really stretching it. I mean, that's a very serious injury. Now, the doctors all said it was a good repair. He doesn't have a long history of injury to that leg. It's not like it's been reconstructed two or three times. He's been healthy to this point. But if he's back for week one, and I'm not talking about preseason, I'm talking about week one of the regular season next year, that's going to be impressive. I mean, I think it's not impossible that he may be It may be 2-3 weeks into the season before he's ready to play. And they have to be smart with it. They can't push him. Well, he's going to push himself because that's just the kind of person he is. But they can't push the timetable up beyond what's good for him. If he's not ready until week three, he's got to be ready in week three. And I think they're smart enough that they're not going to do that.
Okay, so back to the game on Saturday. Does Jim Schwartz's defense win this for the Eagles, Mike?
I would maintain it would have to, given the way the offense has looked the last couple of games, given Wentz's absence, all the things we've discussed. I would argue this, when Wentz was healthy, the two reasons to think that the Eagles could go on and reach and perhaps win the Super Bowl was Wentz's presence and his play and the fact that the Eagles – kind of collective strength was in their defensive line and their front seven players in their defense. They are able to put pressure on opposing quarterbacks, sack them, get after them without having to blitz a lot, which is we've seen that formula work in the past when the Giants have beaten the Patriots in their Super Bowls. That's contributed a lot to them being able to stop Tom Brady and the Patriots offense. I would argue that if the Eagles are going to beat the Falcons, those front four players – Brandon Graham, Fletcher Cox, Timmy Jernigan, guys like that are going to have to win the battle in the trenches against the Falcons' offensive line and make things difficult for Matt Ryan.
Take us back. Who did we lose to injury this season, aside from Wentz, of course?
A lot of guys.
Yeah.
I mean, they lost very early in the season. They lost Darren Sproles. And then they lost Ronald Darby for a good part of the season. He's back now, but that was an injury. They lost Jason Peters, who's their anchor at left tackle. They lost Jordan Hicks, who's a middle linebacker and a very good player. People don't talk about that a whole lot. I think one of the things that I kind of think these guys didn't get enough credit for was what they did overcome to get to 13-3. I mean, it's a lot. Most teams get to 13-3. One of the things you look back at and say, boy, they stayed healthy all year. All their key guys, they had them all season. That's one of the things that was good for the Falcons last year. Falcons were a really healthy team last year. It's part of the reason they got to the Super Bowl. Well, the Eagles lost not just guys, but important guys, and played through it. I've been thinking in the last couple weeks, I mean, he was injured so long ago that people have kind of forgotten about him. But how good it would be to have Darren Sproles now.
Yeah.
I mean, he is such a great matchup player against a defense like the Falcons, and a quarterback like Nick Foles that you need to try and get him some easy throws. I mean, that little swing pass to Sproles out of the backfield, he can take a little 5-yard pass, make a guy miss, and turn it into a 40-yard play. I mean, they've gotten good play out of the running backs that they have now, but Sproles would be just a tremendous addition to this offense. You're not going to have him, but I've been thinking about it this past week of just how great it would be to have him back.
Gets you kind of excited for next year.
If he's back next year, and he wants to be.
Oh, Sproles?
Yeah.
Yeah. Why wouldn't he be?
Well, he's 34, I believe, okay. Which is ancient in NFL terms.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's get to some comments. We've got two which are kind of contrasting. Charles sends an email, says, with Carson Wentz, the Eagles can beat any team in the league. With Nick Foles, the Eagles can lose to any team in the league. And then there's another comment which says, Eagles over the Falcons 24-17. Ray, I'm not sure where that's coming from, but we were talking about this coming in. There was a fake Facebook page set up with your name that, that claimed you said 24-17. I don't know if this is where this person is getting this
possibly.
From.
Yeah, that's been up there for a while.
Yeah, just to kind of let people know.
I aspire to have people create fake Facebook pages about me.
You know you've made it when.
Exactly.
Right? But, I mean, even with Carson Wentz healthy, I mean, you were talking, I guess, I think it was off mic, Ray, about how the Saints are the team, probably the best team in the NFC.
Well, I think they're the most complete team in the NFC.
Okay.
The Minnesota Vikings have a really good defense. I mean, the Minnesota Vikings defense right now is as good a defense as I've seen in a while. I mean, this defense is I think, better than the Denver defense that won a Super Bowl a couple years ago. I think it's on a par with the Seattle defense that won a Super Bowl a couple years ago. I mean, these guys are really good. Now, they haven't been on national TV a lot, so I don't think a whole lot of people have seen them, but they're really, really good. The Saints are a more balanced team. The Saints have a really good offense. They can run the ball. They have Drew Brees, who can certainly throw the ball, as you saw over the weekend, and their defense is better than it has been in a number of years. So I've said the Saints started this year 0-2, and everybody kind of forgot about them. They kind of wrote them off. But when they started winning, they got 3 wins, 4 wins. And I said at that time, I said, watch out for the Saints. Because they're just, I really like their coach. I think Brees is a great player. And Brees is playing with the kind of sense of mission right now. You can kind of almost see it in his eyes, the way he's playing. He knows his career is winding down. He's 39 years old. Not everybody's Tom Brady that can play into their 40s. And I think Brees is looking at this as, this may be my last best shot at winning the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
So that sort of will, that kind of desire that he has right now is sort of fueling that whole team.
How much longer does New England stay in this? I mean, even New Englanders must be getting tired of the Patriots.
Well that's the big question now. Last week there was a major story in ESPN, the magazine, kind of detailing the fissures and fractures within the organization among Robert Kraft, the owner, Bill Belichick, the coach, and Tom Brady, the quarterback. And what's interesting about that is that Belichick, you know, who's always been, you know, forward-thinking and always looking to kind of keep the hamster wheel churning with respect to the Patriots, you know, was preparing to move on from Tom Brady. You know, that's why they drafted Jimmy Garoppolo. They had two young, promising backup quarterbacks and traded them both away within, you know, a couple of months of each other, I think. And what was surprising about that is it seemed so anti-Belichickian, for lack of a better way of putting it. And as this story detailed, you know, Tom Brady doesn't want to stop playing. He thinks he can play till 45. He's got his TB12 book and routine that he's trying to sell and validate. And Bob Kraft backed him up and said, we're going to stick with Tom. And so it's going to be interesting to see in New England how long Belichick stays around, or whether he decides, you know what, I want to go somewhere else. I want to take some time away from coaching. It's going to be fascinating to see.
Fun to watch. All right. So, again, I will I'd like to reintroduce you guys. Mike Sielski is sports columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Ray Didinger, NBC Sports Philadelphia football analyst. We are talking about football and, in particular, the Eagles-Falcons game at the Link on Saturday. I'm curious to know if any of our listeners dare to try to forecast what's going to happen Saturday. The number is 888-477-9499, or you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. The bye week, does it help or hurt this Eagles team?
I think in this situation it helped.
Rest?
You know, A, rest. B, given the way Nick Foles had played against the Cowboys and the Raiders, it gave them a week to kind of clear his mind, clear the slate, take an extra week to kind of go over film and prep and all that sort of stuff.
Sometimes the longer you have to think about it, the worse it is, though.
Well, maybe. But I also think that if the Eagles had been rolling at the close of the regular season and then had to take a week off, the greater risk would have been, okay, it disrupts their rhythm. And, you know, we saw that, for instance, last season. The Dallas Cowboys were 13-3, and they got a bye week. And they play the Green Bay Packers and Aaron Rodgers, and they get off to a slightly slow start in that game, the Cowboys, and the Packers build a big lead on them, and it takes them almost the first half to kind of get their sea legs, and they come back, and it's a great game, but the Packers pull it out in the end, and in large part because they had built that early lead in the game because the Cowboys were rusty.
Ray, what do you think?
I think it helped. I think it helped a lot. First of all, the week's rest is a very good thing. I mean, if you just look back to 1990, when the current playoff format was created, teams that have had that bye week before they start the playoffs are 79-29. Now they were the top two seeds, so you would say they were the better teams anyway, but I definitely think the week's rest at this point in the year really does help you. Yeah. And I really do think, I think Mike was right when he said this, that I think Nick really needed the week. He needed the week to kind of refocus, to sort of sit down, look at the tape, look at the films, look at what he did wrong, and work out, along with the coaches, a game plan that's workable for the opponent that they're going to face this week. I think they needed the time to strategize. One of the problems with Nick is Nick just needs work. I mean, he just hasn't played much football. I mean, we talked about this. The fact was, I mean, he was limited in the spring because of the elbow issue. He didn't play a snap in the whole preseason. Then he comes into the regular season, and once you get to the regular season, the backup quarterback doesn't take any reps at all. It's the starting quarterback gets all the reps. So Nick Foles has basically been standing with his arms folded for the whole season. And I think part of what you're dealing with now is he's just got to kind of get back into the rhythm of this. So every practice, every session he has now is to his benefit.
So, Mike Sielski, on Friday, this past Friday, the headline to your column read, "Fans fooling themselves that the Link is an edge." So, home field advantage is an illusion?
No, the home field advantage is not an illusion. The Eagles certainly have a home field advantage at Lincoln Financial Field, and of course, they're better for having that in the postseason. The point of what I was trying to convey was that relative to other home field advantages that teams enjoy around the NFL, the Link doesn't provide as great of one.
Yeah, but it's cold. It's been really wintry, although I think Saturday's supposed to be someplace in the 50s or high 40s, which isn't bad.
It's going to be balmy on Saturday.
Yeah, and as you write, I think the Falcons are a dome home team. I don't know if those are your – that's your –
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
This is me. Now, I've relied a lot on a study that a writer for ESPN.com conducted in August, in which he basically compared how a team fares at home versus how it fares on the road and averages things out. And the gap that the Eagles enjoy, every team enjoys an advantage at home, but the points per game advantage that the Eagles get at the Link is not great compared to, say, what the Seahawks get in Seattle at CenturyLink Field.
Yeah, I've been there.
Yeah, it's loud. And I would maintain that part of the reason for this is that kind of the default reaction for Philadelphia sports fans, and I don't blame them for this because the city celebrated only one championship in 34 years, is that when things start to go a little hairy or not quite the right way, the default reaction is an unbridled optimism. It's dread. It's, we've seen this before. We start looking to the sky for the anvil or the safe that's going to fall on our heads. And so that atmosphere is not necessarily ideal for a home team kind of pulling through
that's
all
challenged.
The time. Yeah.
All right. Well, so what is your advice then on Saturday? If things start to head south, instead of just letting, you know, their feelings be known,
they need to keep the booze in check. I really think that, especially given that Nick Foles is the quarterback. Mm-hmm. And, you know, after the Cowboys game that we've been referencing, the final regular season game, during his post-game press conference, he used the word confident or derivative thereof 11 times. It was the whole, like, methinks thou doth protest too much. You know, I'm really confident. Let me tell you how confident I am. I am so confident. Really, really confident. So I think fans need to go into that game saying, hey, look, if they go 3-and-out on the first drive, hold it together.
Yeah.
Because the Eagles are going to need every bit of good thought that they can get.
Because it can make it worse.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think it's important that they get off to a good start. I think it's really important to get off to a good start because, look, the fans are going to show up. Every seat's going to be filled. They're going to come with tremendous energy. At the opening kickoff, the building's going to be rocking. It really will. But every person there has that feeling of dread because they've been living with this now ever since Wentz went down, that, oh, my God, the season's lost. We can't win this way. But, I mean, they're going to summon up everything they can summon up to start the game. But how deep does that go? If things, you know, if Foles turns the ball over in the first series and Atlanta turns it into a quick touchdown at 7-0, I don't know if people are going to start booing, but it's certainly just going to suck.
Quiet.
It's going to suck the life out of the stadium. So the Eagles need – this is a tough matchup and a good team that they're playing. They need to have the fans in the game for four quarters.
So just very quickly before we head to the break, out in Seattle, I visit there. I've got family there, and I've seen the 12th man flags, and the city's lit up in blue and green during the holidays and the whole thing. But the fans there, how is it different? How do they relate to that team differently at CenturyLink Field than the fans do here in Philadelphia? You know, when things are going south, are they as hard on the team?
Well, I think there's two factors. Number one, when CenturyLink Field was built, it was designed to augment fan noise. I mean, they literally built the stadium to make it as loud as possible. So that's part of it. Just from a architectural standpoint, the place is louder than Lincoln Financial Field. The second thing is, I think Philadelphia and is in some ways unique. I think Boston is similar to a degree. New York is similar to a degree where our collective identity, our civic identity is so tied up in sports that when things go bad for one of our teams, it's as if things are going bad for us. And that's hard to overcome. That's kind of written into our DNA. And there hasn't been a lot of success over a long period of time here. So our natural default position is, oh my God, it's happening again.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens on Saturday. We're talking Eagles, Falcons, and maybe some Sixers and Flyers, too, after the break. In studio, Mike Sielski of the Philadelphia Inquirer and Ray Dinger of NBC Sports Philadelphia. And we'll get to some of your comments as well. Keep it here. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. And again, we're talking about the Eagles and the Falcons on Saturday at the Link. And we'll get into some Sixers and some Flyers as well. In studio with us, Ray Dinger, commentator for NBC Sports Philadelphia, and Mike Sielski, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Back talking about sports with us here on Radio Times. A couple more quick questions about the Eagles. Running back Jay Ajayi did not play against the Cowboys. He wasn't at practice last Wednesday, but I guess he came back on Thursday. You know, Coach Peterson referenced his knee. What's going on there?
Well,
anything major?
Well, he's had knee problems in the past. He had injured the knee in college, and part of the reason that the Miami Dolphins gave for trading Ajayi to the Eagles in the middle of this season was that, at least in terms of whispers and off the record or on background sourcing, was that they were worried about his long term future in the league because of that knee, that he wasn't running as well as he could have. So I would say the proof is going to be in the pudding on Sunday. The Eagles haven't played him as much as he had played in Miami. They have some other running backs, and they've kind of done it by committee even since Ajayi showed up. But Ajayi is clearly the most talented running back they have. And if they're going to decide, hey, we've got to lean on a guy in this game to get us home, Ajayi is probably going to be the guy if he's healthy enough to do it.
All right, so on the Falcons side, wide receiver Julio Jones missed practice on Tuesday. Ankle injury, he might be back for a little bit today. I mean, what is this? How does this help the Eagles, if at all?
Well, Julio's been hampered by various injuries. Nothing serious enough to take him out of the lineup, but he's been less than 100% healthy a good portion of the year.
Hasn't been in the red zone that often.
But he's still Julio Jones. I mean, yeah. I mean, you're looking. People say, well, he had an off year, 1,600 yards receiving. I mean, it's. I mean, he.
For him.
Yeah, there was. I mean, he's still a great player. And when they came right down to it, when they needed the big play to put away the Rams on the weekend. They threw it to Julio Jones. So is he not? Is he 100%? No, but he's certainly going to be. He's certainly going to be the guy that when Matt Ryan gets in trouble on Saturday, he's the guy he's still going to be looking for.
All right. To our comments, we have a tweet from Lehigh Football Nation. The Falcons are peaking at the right time and have figured out how to stop the run. Foles will have to beat them through the air, and this spells trouble for the Eagles. Mike Sielski.
Yeah, I mean, the Falcons defense has played very well lately. You know, we've talked about, you know, their speed. They do the same thing. They play the same kind of system virtually every single play. They don't mix things up. And so it's very much like, hey, this is what we do. You know, we're not going to try to surprise you. We're just going to perform and play better than you play. And they have an excellent pair of cornerbacks, which kind of those two guys allow them to play that way. And so I think that the tweeter there is right that, you know, some of this is going to come down to Foles and his willingness to try to make difficult throws. One of the things with one of the questions that came up since Foles took over for Carson Wentz is that the Eagles' best wide receiver is Alshon Jeffrey. And Jeffrey is not a guy who gets wide open when he catches passes. That's not his style. He's a tall, kind of played basketball in high school, kind of boxes out defensive backs, and is very adept at making contested catches. You basically throw the ball up to him, and even if there's a guy covering him, he will go get it. And Foles has been a little hesitant to give him those opportunities.
And as you were saying, Ray, maybe that's because Foles just has not had much of a chance this season to do that sort of thing.
Well, I think he's working off some rust, and I think he's had to do that. But also, these two corners are really good. Desmond Trufant and Robert Alford are really good. And they're going to lock down the Eagles' wide receivers. They just are. I mean, they just are. So with the Eagles, and the idea that the Eagles can win this game purely with defense and purely by running the ball and play around their quarterback, it can't happen. I mean, Nick is going to have to make some plays. You can't win a playoff game. You can't win a playoff. I guess you could argue that Blake Bortles maybe did, but that's the exception. But you can't win a playoff game without your quarterback making some plays, making some throws. And that's when I said it's going to fall on Doug Peterson, because some of this he's going to have to do by design. His receivers aren't going to run their way open. You're going to have to scheme a way to get them open. To me, this looks like a big game for the tight end. I think Zach Ertz is going to be a big factor. And I think Nelson Aguilar, the third slot, the slot receiver. I think you're going to have to divine like bunch formations, pick plays, rub routes, those kinds of things that are going to bump these guys off. Because if you just try and play them straight up, your wide receivers aren't going to get open.
And a tweet from ATP. Do you start the game with your strength and go on defense if you win the coin toss and let Foles and offense start after a tone is set?
Most teams do defer. I think that's, by and large, you look around the league, most teams, if they win the opening toss, they will defer. They want to get their defense on the field first, and they want to have the opportunity to get the ball coming out of halftime. So I would expect, yeah, especially the way the Eagles are set up right now, I would fully expect them to do that.
Email from Tom. Please ask if there might be a mismatch on offensive and defensive lines to watch for both teams, please, Mike.
Well, Fletcher Cox, the Eagles' defensive tackle, creates a mismatch against just about anybody who he would face. Now, it's an interesting matchup this week because the Falcons center is a guy named Alex Mack, who is one of the three or four best centers in the NFL. So that's one to watch. I don't know that that's necessarily a one-sided matchup, but it's one to keep an eye on. That if the Eagles are going to shut down the Falcons offense and pressure Matt Ryan, part of that pressure has to come up from up the middle, and that's on Cox and that's on Timmy Jernigan, their other defensive tackle. And so that's going to be something interesting to watch.
All right. Looking ahead, so Jim Schwartz, the Eagles defensive coordinator, has interviewed with the Cardinals for a potential head coach job, right? We're talking maybe the Giants. Not sure about what's going on there?
Maybe, maybe not.
Okay. But if he does leave the Eagles, what sort of hole does this make for the team?
Right. It'd be a big one because Schwartz has done a very good job as the defensive coordinator. But, I mean, Jim, there's no question Jim wants to be a head coach again. I mean, he had the one opportunity in Detroit, and he's come here and he walked into a good situation, a good team, and he contributed a lot to this year. I mean, coming into this year, part of the reason when Mike and I were in here with you back in September and saying 8-8, 9-7 for the Eagles, it was largely because we had real questions about the defense, especially the defensive secondary. And Nev played really well. Now, some young guys have stepped up and played really good, but I think a lot of it goes back to the coaching. I think these guys are really well coached, and I think Schwartz has given them a really good scheme. So this season has been a great job interview for him. And I think he's, you know, I know he's on a lot of teams' short list. I sort of rule out the Giants. I mean, I know he's been linked with the Giants. Giants don't hire defensive head coaches. They just don't. The last defensive head coach they had was Parcells, and that's going back a ways. All the hires since then have been about offense. I think they're going to go offense again.
So what is your gut then? Do you think he's going to be here next year?
I would be surprised if he were here next season. As Ray said, he's a very ambitious guy.
Yeah.
He wants to be a head coach again.
Yeah.
I'm sure he feels like the situation that he was in Detroit, you know, I believe he took over after they went 0-16. They were the first team to go 0-16 in a regular season, not the first team to go winless. But he got them to the playoffs. And I'm sure he feels like, hey, you know, I deserve another chance. I want another chance. I think the question becomes, you know, what franchise is the right matchup for him? Now, there was reported earlier today that apparently the Giants are close to hiring Matt Patricia, the Patriots' defensive coordinator, as their head coach. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But I think Schwartz will end up somewhere as a head coach.
Let's talk about some other potential poaching before we go on to the Sixers. Frank Reich, offensive coordinator, does he stay around? Right.
I haven't heard of him being interviewed by
anyone. Me neither.
No.
I mean, we've heard about John DeFilippo, who's the quarterback coach.
That was the next question.
Several teams have interviewed him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, listen, John has for a guy who's not a coordinator, has a very high profile around the league. Everybody knows about him. He has a lot of respect. And he's the guy that's given a tremendous amount of credit for the development of Carson Wentz. So, yeah, I think it would not surprise me at all if John DeFilippo. People would say, oh, you know, a head coach, this guy's never been a coordinator, never been a head coach. We've seen it before. I mean, teams are willing to take a shot with young coaches. I think you look at what Sean McVay, who's 31 years old, looks like a kid. People thought, oh, you that young? Well, I think a lot of owners are looking at the success of a McVay and saying, let's go find my own Sean McVay.
Right.
And John DeFilippo, I think, kind of fits that description.
Especially because the age of players now is trending younger all the time. You know, so do you want the crusty old veteran, you know, guy, you know, to be your head coach, or do you want someone who's possibly going to relate better to this younger generation than the crusty old veteran guy would?
All right, to the Sixers.
Which I say as I sit next to a crusty old veteran.
You're smiling, right? I'm crusty old veteran,
called, too. I've been called worse.
All right, so the Sixers, I think 19 wins, 19 losses, that's where they are right now?
Mm-hmm, right.
Okay, so this time last year, of course, they looked a heck of a lot worse. Is this where you thought they'd be, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I thought the beginning of the year that they would be a team that would be, I thought actually a little over 500, and I thought they'd be in the playoffs. You know, I think that they've got some real talent on that team, and they're playing hard. You know, they're frustrating in that they've let some very winnable games get away in the fourth quarter. They've gotten sloppy with the ball, and they've kind of beaten themselves in a couple of situations. But the last few times out, they've played good, and I expect that they're going to play better the second half of the year. So I'm still sticking with what I said. I think they'll be a playoff team.
Mm. And so they're in London. Well, they're in London right now. They're playing on Thursday.
Yes.
Why does the NBA have a regular season game in London every year for, what, the past eight seasons?
Because basketball is a global business and a global sport. And there is something about the nature of the sport that has made it a touchstone in places like England and China and Brazil. You know, whether it's the high-profile nature of the individual stars, the branding that they've done, whatever the case may be. And it's telling about what the NBA thinks the Sixers, what kind of team they think the Sixers can be, that they are one of the two teams playing in London this year. They're playing the Boston Celtics, and the Celtics were already a good team, you know, and probably got better in the offseason and have been better this season. But it says something that the NBA said, okay, Sixers, you and Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons, let's showcase you guys in London.
So the Celtics are first in the Eastern Conference. Sixers are ninth. Is that where they are?
Yeah, they're just outside.
And the Sixers have said they want to win this game. Of course they're going to say that, but, you know, what are the odds? It's a regular season game that they might be able to get past the Celtics.
Yeah, I mean, the Celtics are a better team, you know, by a significant margin at this point. But games like this for a team like the Sixers are always good. They're always helpful as benchmarks. It's, okay, this is where we think we might be in comparison to Team X or Team Y. You know, the Cleveland Cavaliers came into Philadelphia earlier this season at a time the Sixers were playing really well, and they pretty much stepped on the Sixers' throats. LeBron James had a terrific game. The Cavaliers blew them out, and it was kind of like, okay, it's nice that you guys are young and talented and think you're really good, but here's where you really have to be to compete for a championship.
Rookie Markelle Fultz still out for medical reasons. I think I was reading scapular muscle imbalance. Not sure what that is in one of his shoulders. But what does it mean for the Sixers team when he's finally in play?
I don't know how you're going to work him in, really. He's back practicing now, which means he's closer to playing. But I just don't know how good a fit he's going to be. I mean, he's basically here as a point guard. But it seems to me that Ben Simmons is your point guard. Fultz is not a good enough outside shooter to be the two guard. I mean, he's going to have to be the point guard, the guy that's going to run the offense, but it seems to me the offense right now is running around Simmons. So I just think it's going to be hard. I think it's going to be hard to incorporate this kid this season. You know, I think when he's available, he'll probably play some minutes, but I think right now I don't see – he's almost – I think where he is right now, he's almost a square peg in a round hole. Mm.
J.J. Redick, 33 years old, at the pinnacle of his career. How long does he keep this up, Mike?
You know, he's in great shape. He's still a, you know, one of the five or six best three-point shooters in the league. He provides a dimension that the Sixers absolutely need to have, which is a player on the perimeter that can keep a defense honest so that they don't have to collapse down and can't collapse down on Joel Embiid every time he has the ball. Part of the reason he's so essential is that Ben Simmons, as talented a player as he is, does not like to take shots from the outside and is overt about the fact that he does not like to shoot from the outside. So until that changes, and even if that changes, you're going to need a player like Redick to create that space, to keep defenses honest. And let's face it, the sport of basketball now is no longer throw the ball into the big guy and have him dunk it or put up a layup. It is work the ball around the perimeter to find an open three-point shooter. The Golden State Warriors and Houston Rockets have really, in a way, kind of revolutionized the sport in that regard.
So what does Brett Brown need to do to move this team forward, looking ahead to next season? And how many more years does he have with this organization? How much rope does he have, Ray?
I don't know. I mean, if you're around the team at all, Mike's around it far more than I am. I don't get the sense that there's any lack of confidence in him. I mean, I get the feeling that the management's they hired him for a reason. He certainly slogged through all those bad years and was the good soldier all those years that he had to go out and coach a bunch of guys that were basically CBA players, and he did that without complaint. And I think he's done a pretty good job of developing the young guys. He's a guy that I think is a good teacher, and basically you got so many young players here. I think a teacher is really what you're looking for.
It's interesting because the ownership hired him, but the general manager did not. Brian Colangelo did not hire him. So I think Brett is a good coach. I think Brett has done well as kind of the face of the quote-unquote process. He's the guy everybody goes to talk to about this, and he takes the bullets. He answers the questions and does all those things. So I think a lot of it depends on how this season plays out. If the Sixers were to make the playoffs, I think Brett stays. I think if they don't make the playoffs, then it becomes an open question. Mm-hmm. If for no other reason than Brian Colangelo didn't hire him, and every general manager wants the chance to put his stamp on a team as in terms of hiring my guy. And while they get along well, that's always going to be there.
All right, we've got less than a minute for the Flyers. Sorry about that, Flyers. How would you characterize this Flyers team, Ray?
I think they are frustrating. Some nights they'll play very well. And other nights they come out and look, they don't show up. That to me is, I'm really concerned about that. They have talent. They have talent on this roster, but they're very inconsistent, and their habit of starting games slowly bothers me. I mean, to me, I think it's a reflection on the coaching. I really do.
10 seconds, Mike.
I think at the end of the season is when the evaluation is going to be made, both on the coach and on their entire rebuilding process.
All right. Well, as always, it's been great to have you guys in studio with us. Thank you so much for Radio Times. Mike Sielski, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Appreciate you coming out today.
Thanks so much, Mary.
And Ray Didinger, commentator for NBC Sports Philadelphia. Great to see you again.
Same here, Mary.
And as always, don't forget to visit our Facebook page and check out our podcasts. You'll find everything at whyy.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Bob Alls. Our producer is Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. And for now, now, let's go out on a really cool rendition of the Eagles' fight song. I don't know if you guys have heard this, but it's conducted by the Philadelphia Orchestra. Let's take a listen.